They'll respect your papers. You have to leave for the sake of the children. In England, you are 10 times safer, despite the war." At that moment, Ollo jumped to her feet with a cry and ran upstairs, sobbing. Ursula found her lying on her bed, shaking and pale, staring at the ceiling. "What's the matter? Are you sick?"
"I'm not sick, but I understand everything," she replied.
"What are you talking about?"
Ollo sat up and slapped the edge of the bed. "You have taken me for a fool, but I won't let you. Don't act so innocent. You planned everything and thought I wouldn't notice until it was too late, but you were wrong."
"I still don't know what you mean," said Ursula, amazed by the outburst.
"You know perfectly well. You wanted the new passport to get out of here with the children. You want to go with them and Len to England and leave me here alone, without Nina, because as a German I can't go with them. That's the thanks I get."
Ursula calmly insisted she was not planning to leave Switzerland, and Ollo's hysteria slowly subsided. But the nanny's fears were not unfounded. If the Germans invaded, her family would flee with their British passports, and she would be left behind. War could drive a brutal wedge between Ollo and Ursula, and they both knew it. A few days later, Ollo took Ursula aside, tearfully declared she could not live without Nina, and made a proposition. "Why don't you go to England and leave Nina with me? Wouldn't that be better? I won't need any money. I will work my fingers to the bone and the child would lack nothing. Do you really want to expose Nina to German bombs in England? Do you want to be responsible for dragging the little one into that danger? When times calm down, I will bring the child to you." From Ollo's perspective, the idea seemed entirely logical. Ursula was busy with her espionage and her new husband. She might read to her children and take them for long walks and skiing expeditions, but in Ollo's eyes she was as deficient a parent as her mother had been. It was Ollo who combed the nits from Nina's hair, shared her private toddler language, and soothed her to sleep with German lullabies. 9-year-old Misha was rejecting her, but Nina was still her baby, and she would not be parted from her. Suddenly, Ursula was very scared. Adored Ollo, her family's rock for so many years, was trying to take away her child. Ursula did not even address this outrageous suggestion. Instead, she changed the subject. "Why not take a holiday?" she said. "I'll find you a nice place, and in a few weeks you can come back." Ollo snapped. "No, I won't be forced to leave here. I am not going to let you out of my sight. You can be sure of that." The molehill now crackled with tension. Ollo stopped eating, wept copiously, and barely spoke, exuding a silent bitterness. At night, she locked the door to the room she still shared with Nina, fearful that Ursula might take the baby while she slept and steal away in the night. She obtained a pair of binoculars. Where did she get them, Ursula wondered. And whenever she was not working, she perched on the hillside above the house, watching them. When I talked to Len alone, she tried to listen at the door. The spy was being spied upon. Ollo began to steam open Ursula's letters. One afternoon, Ursula returned from Geneva after collecting a fresh batch of Rado's reports from the dead drop site to find a letter from her parents. Even if the envelope had not been so clumsily resealed, Ollo's thunderous expression would have revealed that she had read the contents. The letter was an entreaty, urging Ursula to leave Switzerland. "If you stay there until Hitler invades the country, death is certain. If the work of your husband, whom we do not know, keeps you there, then at least send us the children. But if he understands the situation, he will see to it that you come here too." For Ollo, the letter was confirmation. She was about to be deserted and deprived of her child. The next day, Olga Moot put on her hat and announced she was going to the hairdresser. Instead, she went at once to the British consulate in Montreux. Angry and determined, Ollo had framed a plot of her own. She would prevent Ursula from leaving with Nina by revealing to the British that her employer was a communist spy. Ursula later depicted this as the work of an unhinged mind, but by Ollo's own lights, her plan was perfectly rational. She had loved each successive child of the Kaczynski family, but her attachment to Nina carried an additional element of desperation, the infatuation of an aging, childless, terrified woman at the mercy of international events she barely understood. Ollo saw herself as the victim of a cruel betrayal. She had given everything to the family, and now Ursula had contrived an escape plan that excluded her. She would tell the British government that the newly minted Mrs. Leon Burton was a spy who had married solely for the purposes of obtaining British citizenship. The King of England would then withdraw Ursula's passport and they could all happily remain in Switzerland. After she had explained everything to the British, she would have her hair done and then visit Lillian. That was Ollo's scheme. It did not work out. Olga Moot spoke only a few words of English. The official at the British consulate had French, almost no German, and very little time to spare. With so many people seeking refuge in Britain, the consulate was bombarded with requests, inquiries, rumours and denunciations, some realistic, many frantic, and some simply mad. Ollo gave the official her name and address, and then launched into a deafening torrent of what she thought was English, but was really German, with odd shards of English thrown in. Like many people unable to speak a foreign language, Ollo believed that volume would compensate for a limited vocabulary. Her ravings in broken English were so incoherent, Foote later wrote, that when she paused for breath, the official stood up and asked her, very courteously, to go away. He then added her name to the list of lunatics who pestered the consulate daily. Frustrated and surprised by this setback, Ollo confided in her hairdresser, as people bizarrely often do, and asked him which branch of Swiss officialdom she should go to in order to denounce her employer. The coiffeur, an anti-Nazi to his roots, wanted nothing to do with the business. He was also, she felt, deliberately rough with her hair. Ollo needed an English speaker who would explain the situation to the British on her behalf. She arrived at the door to Lillian Jacobi's flat, agitated and confused, her hair in a mess. Lillian insisted she lie down and take some valerian drops, a natural remedy for anxiety. "You must help me," Ollo repeated. "You must come with me. You know that I cannot live without Nina. Please come with me right now." Lillian was baffled. Ollo continued to rant. "I have known for ages they want to leave Switzerland, even though they act as if that isn't the case. They are evil people. They lied to me and want to abandon me, but I am not giving up Nina." Ollo described how she had already tried to tell the British authorities that Ursula and Len were communists who secretly ran a radio station at night so that England wouldn't let them in and they'd have to stay here. But for some reason, she had not been properly understood. That was why Lillian must accompany her to the consulate and explain everything again properly. Lillian was stunned to learn that Ursula was a spy, but horrified by Ollo's treachery in revealing this to the authorities. "For God's sake, what have you done? They could be arrested at any moment." The nanny's response was chilling. "Then I will have the child," she said, and burst into tears. Ollo had gone to the wrong person. Lillian stood over the woman bawling on her sofa and delivered a ferocious rebuke. "When your mind is clear, you will never be happy again. You will suffer forever from the terrible guilt you have burdened yourself with. Don't you realize what a betrayal you are committing? No decent person will forgive you if you plunge this family into misery. I regard your condition as an illness and want to help you, Of course, I had no idea they were secret communists, but I tell you honestly, I can only admire that. She told Ollo to go home and say nothing about the day's events to Ursula, who was due to go shopping in Montreux the next day. The moment Ursula alighted from the train, Lillian steered her into a nearby park. Something terrible has happened. Ursula was astonished, livid, and very frightened. Who else had Ollo confided in? Would the hairdresser go to the police? Ollo knew nothing about Rado, so the network was probably safe for the moment, but she certainly knew the identity and whereabouts of Alexander Foote. Even Rudy, wherever he was, would be in danger if Ollo told the Nazis what she knew. Ursula had evaded the Chinese secret police and the British authorities in Shanghai, the Japanese Kempeitai, the Swiss and Polish security services, MI5 and the Gestapo. No one had ever betrayed her, not Shushin under torture, nor Tumanyan, and none of Stalin's other victims. Even Rudy had kept her secrets safe. But she now faced disaster after being denounced by a woman she had known and loved since the age of 3. Everything that we had laboriously and illegally built up was now threatened with collapse. We had to act immediately. Suddenly, another terrible thought seized her. Ollo had arrived home late the previous evening, looking tired and anxious. She had gone straight to bed and was not up when Ursula left the molehill that morning. Len would be out walking in the hills. What was to stop Ollo from leaving the country with Nina? She might already be on her way to Germany. I had to get back immediately. Ursula caught a taxi to Co, something she had never done before, and ran the last mile uphill to the chalet, her head spinning with terrible fears. If Ollo had taken the baby, she would have to inform the police, but if they intercepted her before the border, she would tell them everything. Yet again, her espionage and her family stood in direct conflict. If the police found out, our work would be over, and that was exactly what could not be allowed to happen. But I had a duty to do everything I could to ensure that my daughter was not taken away from me and placed in the hands of the Nazis, perhaps forever. Panting, she rounded the path above the woods, and there, across the meadow, she saw Nina and Michael playing happily in the sun. My knees went soft. I lay down in the grass, looked up at the sky, and stayed there until my breathing calmed down. That night, when the house was still, she told Len what had happened. They dismantled the radio, carried it through the darkness to the hole in the woods, and then crawled back into bed, wet, dirty, and tired. The next morning, they sat on the bench outside the house, drinking coffee in the cool sunshine, while the children played tag. Ollo was still in her room. The meadows were full of autumn flowers. Nina squeaked with pleasure, and Michael laughed. Len turned to Ursula. She has already spoken to too many people. We have to do something before she turns you and the others over to the police and kidnaps Nina, he said. You will have to kill her. Chapter 15. The Happy Time. Ursula lay awake, wondering whether to murder her nanny. Len was firm. During the Spanish Civil War, he had looked death in the face many times. Unless Ollo was stopped, she could get them all killed. Would she go to the Swiss authorities, or would she even go so far as to contact the German fascists? Espionage is a lethal profession, as Ursula was well aware. The past had required me to deal with death more than once. But the idea of liquidating Olga Moot, whatever her treachery, was more than she could bear. We were not terrorists or criminals, neither unfeeling nor cruel. And Ursula loved her. She recalled Ollo's kindness to her as a child, her stalwart courage when the Gestapo ransacked Schlachtensee, her quiet discretion, her bravery in taking money to Rosa Thalmann in Nazi Germany. She had adapted to the illegal atmosphere wonderfully and supported me as a matter of course.
Ursula blamed herself for the appalling situation.
Her fear of losing us arose out of her love for the child and also for me. Ollo deserved my understanding, my patience. Ollo had risked her life for Ursula. They could not kill her, and she would not give Moscow the opportunity to order her to do so. In the course of a long, sleepless night, Ursula formed a plan. She would smuggle the children somewhere beyond Ollo's reach, secretly rent a flat in Geneva, and install the transmitter receiver there. Then she would fire Olga Moot and send her back to Germany. After that, they would explain to Moscow what had happened and await orders. None of this was possible, however, with Ollo under the same roof, observing their every move. Ursula discussed the situation with Alexander Foote, who expressed sympathy for the faithful old thing, but agreed she was a danger to us all. At any moment, the faithful retainer might try another denunciation. Sensing the stress, the children were fractious. During yet another quarrel with the nanny, Michael called Ollo a witch. She slapped him across the face. Ursula exploded. "Right, that's enough. No one can live with you anymore. The endless weepings, your imaginings, you're driving us all crazy. And now you've hit the boy. That's the end of it." With extreme reluctance, Ollo agreed to move in with the farmer's wife until the atmosphere was calmer. As she left the house, she muttered darkly, "I will not let you out of my sight, you can be sure of that." Early the next morning, a small figure sat hunched on the bench outside the Fuseli farmhouse, her binoculars trained on the molehill. When one of us came out of the door, she lifted up the field glasses. If I went to the village, she focused them in my direction until I was out of sight. A few days later, Frau Fuseli arrived to muck out the cow barn and took Ursula aside. Ollo had told her that Ursula was a spy. "I don't know anything about politics," Frau Fuseli said, "but I understand that war and Hitler are disasters. I'm outraged at what she's done and still intends to do." Ollo was studying the timetable of trains to Germany and planning to go to the German consulate in Geneva. The farmer's wife promised to alert Ursula the moment Ollo left for the city. Frau Fuseli was now spying on Ollo, who was spying on Ursula, and time was running out. Les Réans, a boarding school in a remote area above the lake near Glan, agreed to take in Michael and Nina at short notice, with payment in advance. The German owners seemed kind, and Ursula felt sure they would keep the children for some time if we were arrested. Then she found a two-roomed flat for rent in central Geneva, a place with cold, mortared walls, far from the warm, breathing house on the hillside. The thought of leaving La Taupinière was wrenching. The mountain landscape had become part of my life. It was my daily joy. "I will be lonely," said Frau Fuseli, when Ursula explained that she was departing. The farmer's wife did not need to ask why. That night they packed, and Len took the luggage to the village under cover of darkness, along with the exhumed transmitter. A thick mist blanketed the hill at dawn the next morning as Ursula bundled up the children and they walked down the track to Caux. Len stayed behind, ready to intercept Ollo if she spotted them leaving and attempted to follow. She did not. "The cold autumn fog was kind to us," wrote Ursula. Parting from the children was agony. "How long are you sending us away for?" asked Michael at the gates of the children's home. Nina clung to Ursula and wept. Would I ever see the children again, she wondered. The moment took her back, with excruciating clarity, to the time she had first left Michael in the mountains of Czechoslovakia. "Mummy, stay with Misha, please, Mummy, stay with Misha." Returning to the chalet, Ursula experienced what she called one of my few moments of despair, followed by a fresh flash of anger. All of this not because of my work, I could be brave if that was the case, but due to a crazy old woman. Because of her, we have to leave home, give away the children, interrupt the revolutionary work, and perhaps even go to prison. The nanny arrived at midday to find Ursula in the empty hall.
"Where are the children?" she said. "Where is my Nina?"
"They are safe," Ursula replied. "They are in a place where you cannot reach Nina, even if something happens to me. And it doesn't matter what happens to me now. Do whatever you intend to do. You must know me well enough to know I am not afraid." Ollo's face turned ashen, and she collapsed onto the flagstone floor. "What will become of you now, Ollo?" Ursula asked gently as she cradled the older woman's head in her lap.
"I don't care about anything," Ollo sobbed.
"I can give you enough money for half a year."
"You don't have that much."
Ursula explained that she had sold her brooch, the last object of value she possessed.
"May I come with you to the station?" Ollo asked.
"That will only make it more difficult for you. Allow me this last request." As Ursula climbed aboard the little train at Co, Olga Moot wept silently on the platform.
She knew the farewell was final.
Yet another departing train. Another love gouged out of Ursula's life. The carriage pulled away, and the little woman trotted awkwardly alongside, stumbling and mouthing something through her tears. Ursula could not make out her words. Olga Moot, the loyal and loving traitor, was still standing on the platform as the train rumbled around the bend and out of sight. Moscow's orders were blunt. Get out of Switzerland. Ollo's denunciation to the British authorities had compromised the network. Franz Obermanns was still in prison, and at least three people outside the network were aware of her espionage activities. Agent Sonia was now a liability, and the risk of exposure too great. Major Polyakova instructed Ursula to hand over the transmitter to Foote, install him in her place as Rado's radio operator, and then head for Britain via Vichy France, Spain and Portugal, taking Len and the children with her. Sandor Rado considered Ursula's impending departure to be near desertion. But the owlish spy was impressed by her replacement, the Englishman Jim. Foote struck Rado as intelligent and determined, despite his total lack of political education, and was clearly a talented pupil of Sonia's and an outstanding radio operator with an extraordinary capacity for work. Ursula passed on Moscow's orders. Foote was to train another radio operator for Rado, construct another transmitter receiver, and then move to Lausanne. She would be leaving the network in good shape. "By the end of 1940, wrote Rado, "I had at my disposal two transmitters and three trained radio operators." Len Burton would be one of those operators, and a most unwilling one. Ursula obtained a visa to pass through Spain without difficulty, but Len's application was refused. As a former member of the International Brigades, his name appeared on a list of foreigners unwelcome in Franco's Spain. The Spanish consulate flatly refused to issue a transit visa. He was trapped in Switzerland. Ursula packed her belongings into a single suitcase, collected the children from Les Rayons, and took leave of her few friends remaining in Switzerland. It is even harder to say goodbye to people you love and respect when you know it may be farewell forever, she reflected. In one of her final messages to the centre, Ursula suggested a method for contacting Soviet intelligence once she reached the UK. "Wake Arms, Epping 1 and 15, GMT, point 3. Translated, this meant, "Meet at the Wake Arms pub near Epping Forest, north of London, an inn once frequented by the highwayman Dick Turpin, on the 1st and 15th of each month at 3 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time." Moscow, however, had a different rendezvous point in mind, a street corner south of Marble Arch in central London. The centre also sent a new set of codes and call times, which she passed on to Foote. Ursula was required to inform the British consulate that the UK was her intended destination. When the consul alerted the immigration authorities in London, a series of alarm bells went off. Germans entering the UK were closely monitored, and Ursula ticked just about every suspicious box. The Kaczynski family was already under MI5 surveillance. She had been married to a man with a communistic smell. Her communist brother, Jürgen, had been interned as a security risk. Her father was an anti-war leftist intellectual. Her new husband was a suspected subversive who had fought in Spain and visited Germany immediately before the outbreak of war. The marriage to Burton itself seemed dubious, since she clearly comes from an entirely different social strata. "It looks as though the family is on the move and we should make provision for their arrival," MI5 concluded. "It seems fairly obvious that this is a marriage of convenience, but being British subjects, we cannot refuse to let them come. The husband is already on the blacklist, and it seems best to get her name on the blacklist so that we may keep a close eye on her activities." On the 11th of December 1940, Ursula Burton was formally designated a potential threat to British society. At dawn a week later, Len Burton accompanied her and the children to the bus station in Geneva and stowed their luggage on the roof rack. Len was left standing at the side of the road as the bus pulled out, a forlorn figure in the slush. Married for just 10 months, they would not see each other again for 2 years. On Christmas Eve, the little family finally arrived in Portugal after a hellish journey. 28 hours by bus to Nîmes in southern France, an unexplained 6-hour delay, another 12 hours to the Franco-Spanish border, more waiting while papers were checked and luggage searched on leaving France and arriving in Spain, a night trip north through the Spanish countryside, bright moonlight, little towns asleep, a few hills, and on our left the Mediterranean. Barcelona at 3 a.m., a train to Madrid, and then finally, at 11 p.m. on the 23rd of December, a packed train to Lisbon. A friendly Lithuanian couple allowed the children to sleep in their bed, while Ursula stood in a corridor through the night. At midday, the train creaked into Lisbon station. Ursula found a cheap hotel, a doctor for Nina, whose temperature was soaring, and a doll and some wooden bricks for Christmas presents, and collapsed into a hard bed. Then they waited. People were allocated passage to Britain by ship or plane in order of their importance to the war effort, and Ursula and her children, 3 more German Jews fleeing Hitler, were somewhere near the bottom of that list. Nina recovered quickly. Ursula tried without success to book Len onto a boat from Marseille to Britain, circumnavigating Spain. Before leaving Switzerland, she had withdrawn what little money remained in the bank, and she was already running low on funds. She sent 2 telegrams and 2 letters to her parents, who had recently moved out of London to Oxford, but received no reply. In a letter dated 4th of January, intercepted by MI5, she wrote, "I am here with the kids in Lisboa after rather a tiring trip. We will have to wait at least 3 more weeks. I do not know where we will land. I am rather at a loss why I don't hear from you." Finally, Ursula was informed she would be sailing on the SS Avoceta, bound for Liverpool. MI5 read the passenger list and alerted the immigration authorities in Liverpool. "When she arrives, please give us her destination, description, and the part of the train on which she is travelling. I will then arrange for her to be picked up." Before setting foot on British soil, Ursula was being tailed. On the 14th of January 1941, the SS Avoceta set sail with a convoy of 14 merchant ships carrying iron ore, pit props and fruit, with a Royal Navy escort of 8 vessels as protection against German submarines. The Avoceta, under the command of the convoy commodore Admiral Sir Bertram Thesiger, was a 17-year-old, slow-moving, 300-foot passenger steamer and a tempting target. U-boat captains referred to this as the happy time, die glückliche Zeit, when they were still sinking large amounts of British shipping in the Atlantic, with few losses. For Ursula and the children, the 3-week passage via Gibraltar was anything but happy, a stark contrast to Ursula's last sea cruise with Johann Patra aboard the Conte Verde. They were crushed into a tiny cabin, the porthole screwed shut and blacked out. The children were continuously seasick. Ursula's thoughts were crowded and claustrophobic. Would Len ever get out of Switzerland? What had happened to Rudy? In accordance with the rules, she was forbidden to contact him directly in China, but he had sent frequent letters and postcards to the children. In the spring of 1940, these had abruptly stopped, and she had heard nothing since. His silence was uncharacteristic and deeply worrying. Ursula did not share her fears with Michael. In Britain, she would be spying inside a country at war with Germany. "What sort of work will the centre want me to do?" she wondered. "Will I be capable of carrying it out? What if no one turns up?" The weather was foul, with squalling winds and rolling seas. The crew were tense. Bilious, fretful and bored, Ursula braced for the impact of a German torpedo. Otto Hamburger was anxious. He had not heard from his brother in almost a year. After setting off for Chongqing in the spring of 1940, Rudy had vanished. When Otto opened a suitcase left behind by his brother, he found it was full of communistic material. He feared the worst. But then, early in 1941, Otto received a telephone call from a German business acquaintance in Shanghai, Dieter Flatow, who suggested they meet on a street corner midway between their offices. Dieter explained that his brother Gerhard had sent a telegram from Chongqing written in Rottwelsch, rogue's jargon, the semi-secret language used by thieves and other covert groups in southern Germany. It read, "H's Bruder als Spaher in Kitchen soll wegen Putz werden," which loosely translates as H's Hamburger's brother is in the jug for nosing around spying. Faces being rubbed out, liquidated. The message, meaningless to the Chinese authorities, could not have been clearer to Otto. He immediately called Rudy's communist friend, Johann Patra, who got on the wireless to Moscow. Relations between the USSR and the Republic of China had warmed since the signing of the Sino-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact in 1937, and Moscow was now providing substantial military aid to China's nationalist government in its continuing war with Japan. In January 1941, the relationship further improved with the arrival in Chongqing of General Vasily Chuikov as head of the Soviet military mission. The future victor of the Battle of Stalingrad, Chuikov was now the most senior foreign advisor to Chiang Kai-shek and in a position to ask for favors. 3 weeks later, Rudy Hamburger was taken from his cell in Bai Mansion and brought before the investigating magistrate. After 9 months of captivity, half-starved and ravaged by malaria, he looked like a ghost. Instead of being ordered yet again to confess, he was informed that he would soon be released and allowed to fly to Russia. "The friends had intervened," Rudy wrote. His imprisonment in Happy Valley was over. At the beginning of February, Rudolf Hamburger arrived in Moscow and was taken to a heavily guarded dacha at Kuntsevo, outside the city, near Stalin's personal residence. "The reception was enthusiastic," Rudy wrote in a letter to his father, describing his lodgings in a lovely rest home on a beautiful wooded estate. Incarceration had done nothing to dim his enthusiasm for espionage. If anything, he was even more determined to excel at a job for which he was so singularly ill-suited. The dacha contained a large library, and after months deprived of intellectual stimulation, Rudy gorged himself on the literature of communism. Once a skeptic, Hamburger was now a fully-fledged communist believer. "Four men, Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Stalin, have achieved the greatest spiritual development of the last 50 years," he declared. Despite the unmitigated failure of his first mission, the center had new plans for him. Rudy would be on the move to Turkey, the great borderland between East and West and, like all neutral countries, an espionage hothouse.
The SS Avocetta docked in Liverpool on the afternoon of the 4th of February 1941, and Ursula and the children disembarked, very cold and tired, but relieved to be beyond the reach of German submarines. The foreboding she had felt on board was fully justified. A few months later, the captain of the German U-boat U-203 spied the Avocetta through his periscope and fired four torpedoes into her port side. "She staggered like a stumbling horse," the captain wrote, "and then sank swiftly, taking with her 123 passengers and crew, including 32 women and 20 children. Immigration officer John Pease plucked Ursula out of the line waiting for passport control. The other passengers stared as they were led away. Nina began to cry. The questions came fast. "Where is your husband? What are you going to live on? Why did you leave Switzerland?" After 2 hours, Pease gave the children a penny each, handed Ursula over to Major Taylor of MI5, and typed up his report. "Mrs. Burton is the subject of individual case number 186 in Central Security War Blacklist. She is proceeding to her father, Professor René Robert Kaczynski, 78 Woodstock Road, Oxford. The reason given for leaving Switzerland is that she is afraid to stay any longer owing to her connection with a well-known anti-Nazi family. Her father left Germany about 8 years ago for the same reason and is now occupying a chair at the London University as an expert on population questions. Mr. Burton is unable to leave Switzerland as he cannot obtain a Spanish visa." Now it was Major Taylor's turn to grill Ursula. She had been trained to withstand interrogation and politely answered his questions one after the other. But Taylor was also good at his job, and something about Mrs. Burton did not ring true. She was very vague as to her movements, and it was impossible to check up on her statements owing to the recent issue of her passport. Ursula told him she had met Len Burton in Switzerland, where he was recovering from tuberculosis. But when Taylor pressed her to describe exactly how and when they had met, she said she was not sure. An odd thing for a newlywed to forget. She either could not or would not give even approximate dates. She went on to say that Burton has now recovered from his tuberculosis and had hoped to return with her to England. What was Len doing in Germany immediately before the outbreak of war? Her answer, an unsuccessful attempt to secure money belonging to her which still remained there, sounded like a lie. After 2 hours, Taylor told her she was free to go. Then he sent an urgent message to MI5 headquarters. "You may wish to cause Mrs. Ursula Burton to be kept under observation." Ursula checked into a cheap hotel. A few hours later, they were woken by air raid sirens and ushered into the cellar with other hotel guests as the Luftwaffe bombs rained down on Liverpool docks. They were homeless, virtually penniless, and under bombardment in a country at war. Her first husband had disappeared. Her second was trapped in Switzerland. Her nanny was in Nazi Germany, probably even now divulging her secrets to the Gestapo. But at least Ursula was no longer living in daily fear of capture, deportation to Germany, and the death camps. As the train trundled southwards in the rain through the quiet English countryside, Ursula could feel the accumulated stress and fear begin to ebb. The Nazi spy hunters could not follow her here, but the British ones could.
Chapter 16. Barbarossa. Moscow had chosen a particularly inappropriate place for a rendezvous, smack in the middle of London's red light district. Loitering in Shepherd Market in the deepening dusk, Ursula felt painfully conspicuous. From time to time, a man sidled up from the shadows and she would wave him away. The regular prostitutes were becoming suspicious of this soberly dressed woman who seemed determined to hang around, turning down good customers and undermining business. Ursula's instructions were precise. At 7:15 p.m. on the first day of the month, she should make her way to this street corner east of Hyde Park, where she would be contacted by a military intelligence officer from the Soviet embassy. If he failed to appear, she should return on the 15th. Every fortnight, for 3 months, she caught the train from Oxford and waited among the whores, pimps and drunks. The officer never appeared. One evening, as she made her way through the blackout, the air raid sirens sounded and she was herded off the street into an underground station where thousands of Londoners were following instructions to keep calm and carry on. They unpacked their supper, their thermos flasks of tea, the knitting and the newspapers, Ursula wrote. The city was battered but unbowed. Yesterday I wandered through London, she wrote to Len. The debris of the great department stores bothers me less than a little home in ruins, a line of washing still hanging over the kitchen stove. Instead of cowing the city's inhabitants, the Blitz was having the reverse effect. They hated Hitler and fascism, wrote Ursula. The whole country rose to defend itself. For the first time, she felt proud to be newly British, but frustrated. The battle against fascism was raging, and she was a spectator. She purchased parts for a transmitter, increasingly sure she would never have the opportunity to use it. Something must have happened in Moscow. Her spying career, it seemed, was over. Little hope remained that anyone from the centre would meet me. Like so many refugee families in wartime Britain, the Kaczynskis were dispersed, distracted, and insolvent. With so many fleeing the Blitz to cities outside London, rental accommodation in Oxford was scarce. One landlady insisted she play cards and pray with her every evening. Another threw her out after a few days, unable to endure Ursula's foreign countenance. Over the next 4 months, she and the children moved home 4 times. The Oxfordshire police tracked her movements and reported back to MI5. She is now living at 97 Kingston Road with her sister, noted Detective Constable Charles Jevons. The only people who visit her are her father and his wife. Kaczynski, I am informed, holds strong communist views. Robert Kaczynski had retired from the LSE at the statutory age of 65. Despite his academic eminence, he had little paid work. He is much too proud to be a good job hunter, wrote Ursula. Jürgen, Marguerite, and their 2 small children were crammed into a flat in Hampstead, surviving on whatever he could earn from writing and giving lectures. Jürgen's welcome to his younger sister was distinctly tepid. Alexander Foote later claimed, Jürgen was angry about Sonia's return to the UK because her presence there as a Russian agent might compromise the rest of the Kaczynski family in their political work. Without employment or a permanent home, with few possessions, no husband to provide for the family, and no money coming in from the centre, she faced penury. I was down to the last of my savings, she wrote. I did not reveal these worries to my family. None of them had much to spare. Finally, in April 1941, she found a furnished bungalow for rent at 134 Oxford Road in the village of Kidlington, 5 miles outside Oxford. MI5 was intercepting her letters. They did not, however, spot the pattern of her trips to London and the way she lingered on a dubious street corner before returning to Oxford. For the first time in her life, Ursula began to sink into depression. Her letters to Len were freighted with loneliness and longing. There are so many small things I want you to share. I haven't found any friends yet. This morning I raced off with the pram to fetch a sack of coal. That means our first bath in weeks. Len was continuing to work as a radio operator for Sandorado's Rotodry, but without enthusiasm. The Spanish still refused to issue a transit visa, and he was trapped in Switzerland indefinitely. How much I counted on your coming, she wrote. In 100 ways. We must do this walk together. We must discuss this book. Now I shall have to get used to the fact that such things are not for us. She put on her best clothes, alone, for a man she had known as a husband for only a few months. "I'm wearing a new dress, the first that you do not know. Red, with little white polka dots on it, white belt and white collar." She wondered if he would ever see her wearing it. In late May, she traipsed once more to Shepherd Market and waited disconsolately on the street corner, ignoring the hostile looks of the prostitutes. "I had all but given up hope." Then she saw him. Tough-looking man, thick-set and balding, with big nose and big ears, who could clearly take care of himself in a fight. He was watching her intensely. The man approached me, not the first in this accursed street, but this time he was the one I wanted. Nikolai Vladimirovich Aptekar, a 32-year-old former tractor driver from Odessa, worked as chauffeur and secretary to the air attaché at the Soviet embassy. He was also an officer in the Red Army, operating under the codename Iris, and a key member of the large Soviet military intelligence presence in London. As it did throughout the world, Moscow ran two distinct species of spy in the UK. Legals, intelligence officers like Aptekar, working under diplomatic cover out of the embassy, and illegals, such as Ursula, living as ordinary civilians and therefore without diplomatic protection. Aptekar had graduated from the aviation school in Leningrad and served as an engineer in Bomber Command before being seconded to military intelligence and sent to Britain. He might look like a prize fighter, but Aptekar was a formidable intelligence officer with a good grasp of English and a firm grounding in spycraft and military technology. Aptekar whispered the code word. Ursula responded with another. They immediately parted and walked in opposite directions. Ursula's spirits soared. I glided down the street and along two more as if on wings to the place where we were to talk. "Call me Sergei," said Aptekar a few minutes later in the cover of a shop doorway. She never knew his real name. He conveyed greetings and congratulations from the centre, handed over an envelope containing enough money to allay all my financial worries, and apologised because a car accident had prevented him from coming sooner. "The centre needs news," he said. Britain was not an enemy of the Soviet Union, but neither was she yet an ally. Moscow was hungry for information. "What contacts can you make? In the military? In political circles?" "You are to set up a new information network. When can you have a transmitter working?" She told Aptekar that she could have her radio up and running within 24 hours. Ursula was back in the game. No sooner did she re-establish radio contact with Moscow than events more than 1,000 miles away on the western borders of the Soviet Union transformed the war and Ursula's role in it. On the 22nd of June 1941, Germany attacked Russia. Operation Barbarossa was the largest invasion in the history of warfare. Some 3 million German troops advancing along a 1,800-mile front. This was Hitler's war of extermination, the long-planned operation to liquidate the Jewish and Slavic populations of the Western Soviet Union, create Lebensraum, living space for the German population, and destroy Bolshevism. "We only have to kick the door in and the whole rotten structure will come crashing down," declared the Führer. Millions of dead and 4 years of brutal fighting would eventually prove him disastrously wrong. Soviet spies, including Richard Sorge in Tokyo and Sandor Rado in Switzerland, had sent warnings of the coming invasion, but Stalin refused to believe them. Convinced that as long as Germany remained locked in battle with Britain, Hitler would never open up a two-front war by attacking Russia. His underlings were too terrified to tell him the truth. For Ursula, her family, her husband, ex-husband, former lovers and fellow spies, the outbreak of war on the Eastern Front changed everything. Britain and the Soviet Union were now allies. joined within 6 months by the US after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The Nazi-Soviet pact, anathema to so many communists, was smashed overnight. Ursula was both appalled and elated. The German armies advanced with a series of swift victories, occupying swathes of Soviet territory. It appeared that Moscow would fall and communism itself might perish. Ursula described herself as shattered by the news of the surprise attack. But she was also relieved, no longer burdened by the pretense of supporting Stalin's cynical pact with Hitler. Moscow had made contact at the exact moment her espionage could once again be devoted to destroying Nazism. She was now a combatant, no mere observer, and fighting alongside the British. On the day of Operation Barbarossa, Winston Churchill gave one of the most stirring speeches of the war, broadcast live on the BBC, vowing to fight Hitler on land, air, and sea until, with God's help, we have rid the earth of his shadow. Britain now stood shoulder to shoulder with America and the Soviet Union. The Russian danger is our danger, and the danger of the United States, just as the cause of any Russian fighting for his hearth and home, is the cause of free men and free peoples in every quarter of the globe. Crouched over her radio, Ursula listened, rapt, to Churchill's towering oratory and pronounced it brilliant. Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union made a powerful impact on Britain, she wrote. For several days after Operation Barbarossa, Moscow failed to respond to her messages. When she finally established radio contact, Ursula found the centre avid for intelligence about Britain. What were the politicians and generals really thinking? How sincere were Churchill's words? Would Britain support Russia? Robert Kaczynski, with his wide range of well-connected friends and acquaintances, was uniquely placed to answer such questions. Many of the left-wing economists and Labour politicians he knew were directly involved in the war effort. Ursula chose this moment to recruit her father as a Soviet agent. The professor agreed to supply whatever information he could glean, in the knowledge that she would somehow pass it on to Moscow. He did not know his daughter was an intelligence officer of the Red Army. Robert Kaczynski reported that Britain's leading politicians and soldiers were counting on the Soviet Union's defeat within 3 months. With the end of the Nazi-Soviet pact, Jürgen Kaczynski switched his position overnight. No longer attacking the war as an imperialist ploy, but stoutly defending it as a moral imperative. MI5 observed his change of heart with approval, noting that the communist firebrand had stopped spreading defeatist propaganda among refugees and was now advocating cooperation with the Allied war effort and active help to the USSR. Jürgen also passed on to Ursula everything he could gather that might be of interest or use to Moscow. Although never formally recruited by Soviet military intelligence, Jürgen Kaczynski now had his own code name, Caro. Radio messages to Moscow from the London Residentura, the intelligence section within the Soviet embassy, intercepted in 1941 and decrypted long after the war, show the high esteem in which he was held by Major General Ivan Andreyevich Sklyarov, the chief of military intelligence in London. I unhesitatingly recommend Jürgen Kaczynski. He is a brilliant scholar, a Jew, and an economist of deep Marxist conviction. I know him to be perfectly reliable. He knows not only Germany, but the continent and England, and would be more valuable and trustworthy for us than anyone I know. He is tall, slender, dark, ugly, very brilliant, and very stable politically. Unlike their father, Jürgen knew exactly where the intelligence he passed to Ursula was going. Sonia's network, beginning with members of her own family, would gradually expand into a wide web of informants, providing, consciously or unconsciously, a range of information useful to Moscow, economic, political, technical, and military. At dinner parties in Hampstead, Britain's left-wing intellectuals freely exchanged gossip and secrets, unaware that via one Kaczynski or another, it was all being funneled back to Moscow through Ursula's wireless. One fertile source of information was Hans Kahler, a German communist and former fighter in the International Brigades who, as military correspondent for the American magazines Time and Fortune, had access to highly useful information. A report from the London Residentura to Moscow, sent on the 31st of July 1941 and partially decrypted in the 1960s, noted, Iris had a meeting with Sonia on the 30th of July. The note indicates she was sending daily messages to Moscow at hourly intervals during the night and passing on additional intelligence using microphotographs, the size of full stops, attached to letters and sent to safe houses in neutral Spain or Portugal for collection by Soviet intelligence. The centre was paying her £58 a month, backdated to her arrival in Liverpool, a substantial sum in wartime Britain. Years later, MI5 was still puzzling over the identity of Iris. Probably the English Christian name Iris used as a cover name for a woman. The Russian word iris means either the flower or a kind of toffee. The word seems an unlikely choice as a cover name. Iris was, of course, Nikolai Aptekar, the burly Soviet intelligence officer, who would have been amused to be mistaken for a woman or named after a toffee or a flower. Every fortnight, she caught the train to London to meet Sergei. Never at the same place twice, never for longer than 15 minutes, and usually in the darkness she had always feared. In that blacked-out city, without street lamps or even the glimmer of window light, I was afraid. There was hardly a soul on the streets, and anybody who did pass by was invisible. I stood in the pitch dark, expecting somebody to grab my face or throat at any moment. Whenever I heard gentle footsteps, I would hold my breath in fear and be relieved if they belonged to our man. MI5 continued to watch the Kaczynskis. A memo from February 1941 recorded that various sources had reported Jürgen Kaczynski was in direct contact with Soviet intelligence. But the Anglo-Soviet alliance had shifted MI5's focus. With the Russians on side, the security service was less concerned with monitoring communist subversives than catching Nazi agents. The surveillance of the Kaczynskis dwindled and then almost ceased. In fact, there were no Nazi spies active in Britain. Thanks to the codebreakers at Bletchley Park, every single one was intercepted and either executed or turned. But there were Soviet spies aplenty. The Cambridge Five, Kim Philby, Anthony Blunt, Donald MacLean, Guy Burgess and John Cairncross, all men in positions of authority in the British establishment, and one unobtrusive refugee housewife in Oxfordshire, Agent Sonia, the eyes and ears of Soviet military intelligence in Britain. Ursula saw no contradiction in supporting Russia's allies and spying on them, and nor did her first husband. Rudi Hamburger's new orders were to travel to Turkey, overland via Iran. But as so often in the career of this hapless spy, the plan did not work out. He had got as far as Tehran when Operation Barbarossa redrew the map of war. He could not get a Turkish visa. In August 1941, the British and Soviets launched a joint invasion of Iran to secure the oil fields against seizure by the Germans. Tehran, hitherto a sideshow in the war, was suddenly a place of vital strategic importance, particularly after the Americans arrived to help build the transport infrastructure needed to maintain the flow of fuel and other supplies to Soviet troops on the Eastern Front. Hamburger wrote, "I received instructions to give up trying to get a visa for Turkey and to concentrate on tasks in Iran. Monitoring troop movements, arms shipments, and the military activities of the British and Americans." Hamburger settled down in the Iranian capital and began spying on the Soviet Union's allies with characteristic ineptitude.